children.
It's all for you!
We have such sights to show you.
Too.
Yes. I guess that's a great way to bring it in. But
oh, yeah. Let's do it. Fuck it.
Yeah. Speaking of my tattoo, welcome everyone to another episode of the Horrible People's Podcast. I am your host, Alex Webster. And as always, I am joined by my wonderful co-host, Anthony Fuentes. How are you doing today?
Good. That was the fastest we've ever transitioned to an episode.
I know. I jumped
from
right
conversation.
In.
Normally, that was good.
Well, we didn't record it in the beginning. So my bad.
That was like an Olympic level transition, though. That was good. You went over the high bar. Like with the stance, I like it.
The pole vault.
There we go.
Whatever it's called.
It's not late, guys.
Now the only reason Anthony brought up my tattoo is because I happen to have a death heads moth tattoo on my wrist. Because we are talking about, well, the reason why that is brought up is because. And we're trying to bring it all together.
We're almost there.
We're talking about the Silence of the Lambs today.
Maybe it was supposed to cut in there. I don't know.
We're talking about the Silence of the Lambs today, which is my favorite movie of all time. And if you know me, so last week's hint probably gave it away. It is permanently etched into my body, meaning I have a death head's moth tattoo because
It looks pretty cool.
It's my favorite. I got it for a Friday the 13th special.
Oh, you just doubled up on the horror right there, didn't
you? Yeah, because most tattoo places have like Friday the 13th specials.
Oh, I think
we've discussed this, but most of my tattoos actually are Friday the 13th or like holiday specials because they're cheap.
Oh, just looking for a deal.
Yeah, well, I mean, I love a bargain, but the only issue is that for a lot of those, they're like flash sheets, so you don't get to choose what you want.
Oh, there's like a template there for you.
It just so happened my tattoo artist, who I adore, she had a death heads moth on her flash sheet, and I was like, this is perfect. This is exactly what I want.
The universe is aligning right now.
It's aligning perfectly. So.
I'm poor, and I want that tattoo.
So for full color and shading and everything for this tattoo that normally would probably be like $160, I only paid $60.
Gee, oh, sweet freaking deal right there. That's like 2.5 all-you-can-eat sushi.
The only thing, and I will forever remember this, my worst migraine of my entire life I had while I was getting this tattoo.
Oh, you have monster migraines.
Yeah, which was the worst, because, this was when I was, like, in the hospital. Do you remember that? Like, last year? Like, I posted a picture when I was in the ER, and you were like, dude, are you okay?
Yes, I remember that now.
Yeah, so I was in a tattoo studio, which if you've never been to a tattoo studio, they are very bright and they're very loud. Two places someone with a migraine should not be.
Yeah, that's true.
And I suffered through it because I really wanted this tattoo.
Because you're like, it's a good deal and I want that. I want that.
I went home and like poor DJ, because we wanted to get like Buffalo Wild Wings after. And I like sat in the car and like covered my face. And I was like, no one breathe loudly.
Buffalo Wild Wings have been the worst.
Yeah, I was miserable. Because it was like karaoke night too. Like,
I
sat in the car. DJ went in, got the food. We drove home. And then I just like literally crawled into bed. And like it was dark. It was cold. And I was just like, no one look at me.
Give me a tray for these sauces.
Yeah. It was awful. I turned into a little gremlin. And I think, but I ended up going to, like, the ER, like, right before, right after.
Oh my gosh.
And they were just like, you're fine, you just have a migraine, which I had known. But that's a whole other story. But yeah, that's the story of my Silence of the Lambs
tattoo. There you go, guys. Podcast over. Silence of the Lambs, this is titled this just because... It was the tattoo.
Yeah, because that's just my tattoo story. I like tattoo stories. I think they're fun.
I mean, we could tell them about the movie also.
We could. It's not like Anthony has been working his ass off to bring us the content for this week's episode.
Yeah, it's not like Alex assumes that I was working hard on this one and not just, you know, It's coasting. No, I'm joking. I did work my ass off. I just watched a special on it. It was awesome.
See? Okay, so, I mean, at least you were enjoying yourself.
Yeah, no, it was an hour and 15-minute special.
No, Anthony actually swooped in and saved my butt on this because I, for some reason, have been really swamped with work, so I wasn't able to help with this as much as I'd wanted to. But I appreciate it nonetheless, so.
You're welcome.
We are wrapping up my birthday month with my favorite movie of all time. Not even my favorite horror film of all time, just my favorite movie.
It's a really good fucking movie,
it's
too.
It's so good.
It's, like, just filmically on, like, every level, it's good. And yeah. It got the acclaim. Also, though, sneak preview, guys. Or whatever it is, we got an announcement about the show.
Yeah, we have a huge announcement about the show at the end of the episode, so stay tuned, motherfuckers.
That was good. Wow, yeah, you guys better fucking stay tuned now, Jesus, okay.
I listen to a lot of podcasts, so I know how to grab that attention.
Yeah, but pieces of shit. All
right, let's do it. So let's dive right in with the IMDb synopsis.
Let's do it.
A young FBI cadet must receive the help of an incarcerated and manipulative cannibal killer to catch another serial killer, a madman who skins his victims.
That's the wordiest one of all the IMDb's.
I know. What's with all the, like adjectives?
Multiple syllable, killer. Multiple syllable.
It's incarcerated, manipulative, cannibal, killer. And
another serial killer. Yeah. And some other guy.
Yeah. I feel like that's like, I think that's a fragmented sentence. I don't know.
Yeah, somebody fucked up.
Someone who is an English major who listens, please tell me if I'm correct on that.
If this is just too much.
Yeah. So, this film is directed by Jonathan Demme.
Demme? I think it's Demme.
Demme? I don't know. You watched the special, not me.
Oh, it is Demme, yes.
Demme? Okay. Yeah. My bad. Jonathan Demme, and written by Thomas Harris, who wrote the novel, and Ted Talley, who wrote the screenplay.
Ooh, yeah, we're going to learn about all these guys except Ted Talley, because there's not a lot of information.
duly noted. Of course, the starring actors and actresses in this film, Jodie Foster, yep. Of course, and Anthony fucking Hopkins.
The man.
I mean, is it Sir Anthony Hopkins? Is he knighted?
He is knighted, but by when this movie was being filmed and released, he wasn't knighted yet.
So, is that how that works? So, do we not do the sir?
I was trying to figure this shit out the whole time while writing. You might see a sir randomly thrown in there because whatever. I was very confused.
All right, I don't know. Sir Anthony Hopkins, yeah. Scott Glenn, and Ted Levine.
Yeah, there you go.
It's a short cast, but I mean, there's a lot of like supplementary characters.
There's a lot of extras that like do shit around these characters to make it look like a busy environment.
Jodie Foster's like best girlfriend in the FBI who doesn't have a name.
Oh yeah, she's just kind of there.
Just like token like black female FBI. Yeah, and I'm just like, all right, but what's her name?
We need to do some exposition is her name.
Yeah, like my goodness. But anyway, Anthony is going to take us into some background.
Yes, some really good background. Little is known about the creator of the iconic Dr. Hannibal Lecter. His creator, Thomas Harris, is a very elusive man who actually did not give an interview for press from 1976 to 2019.
Did he give an interview this year?
Yes. It was this year, finally.
So he, broke the silence this year.
He broke the silence of the interviews this year. Yes, he did.
Wow. Yeah. Did you watch it?
No, it was with the New York Times. I don't think it was filmed.
Oh, so it was just like okay.
Yeah, he was just finally talked, and he was just like, oh, here I am. But yeah, for that many years, he just didn't say shit. But when he was 23, he met a real-life doctor/murderer. While visiting a prison in the city of Monterey during a during a trip to Mexico. He was a reporter at this time, so he was doing a story. Harris referred to this man as Dr. Salazar, which is very clearly a fake name.
I mean, it would only be even more fake if it was like Dr. Knife Fingers or like
Dr. Thaddeus Salazar. Hannibal Lecter's not that far.
I know.
Actually, hold on there. Harris might just be very theatrical.
But, yeah.
But
a flair for the dramatic, yeah. Definitely.
Salazar!
So someone, I can definitely envision someone yelling that into the night. Like, yeah. Curse you, Salazar!
Hold on. Okay, yeah, he actually was serving a life sentence, though, for murdering a close friend of his and putting the pieces of his body into a small box.
It's like a combination of Seven and yeah. like Silence of the Lambs. A little bit, you know, it would go on to be, but...
Yeah, it's like a big bevy of influence for those little media.
Well, obviously, like, Seven has not existed yet. Yeah. But,
yeah. I don't think much is known about this guy, actually.
I mean, I believe that. Name, yeah. I mean, it's a fake name, and it's, like, a doctor murderer in Mexico.
Yeah, and I'm sure people have been putting people into boxes for centuries.
Yeah, least, people have been point. Asking what's in the box for yeah. a while now.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, we'll give Fincher some credit on this one.
One day we'll cover Seven, because I have a very fun story about Seven.
Next birthday, there we go. But Dr. Salazar was a small, pale, and elegant man, and he had a very, very big effect on Harris, who was actually at the jail to interview somebody else.
Sounds like Harris is, like, in love with him.
A little bit, huh? He's just like, so was it just one box? Was it like a Tetris situation?
Well, no, it's like the description, small, pale, and elegant, and had a strong effect on Harris. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah, it was weird, because when I read it, small, pale, and elegant is like word for word the description of the source that I pulled. Yeah, weird.
All right.
Yeah, small, pale, and elegant. But eventually, Dr. Salazar would reveal more about his crimes, and Harris would realize just how sadistic Dr. Salazar actually was. Dr. Salazar was actually, this is going to be a tough one, Alfredo Bali Trevino, a physician from an upper-class Monterey family who was found guilty of killing what was likely his lover. He was also suspected of killing several hitchhikers on the outskirts of the city between the 50s and the 60s.
Wow.
Yeah, so I think he just had that reputation, but it's like Mexico in the 50s and 60s, so they don't give a shit. In between the 43 years, the ever-mysterious Thomas Harris avoided press junkets. He set out to create one of the most iconic and terrifying characters in cinema, inspired by this very brief encounter in the 1960s.
Hell yeah.
Yes, and he would go on to create a pretty interesting book, which Alex is going to give us a little lowdown on this one.
Yeah, so in 1981, readers were given an introduction to this cannibalistic and intelligent serial killer in the form of Harris's second novel, Red Dragon.
It's a cool name, I like that.
Of course, yeah. I mean, if anyone is familiar with the Silence of the Lambs franchise, you know that it's all based off of this series.
Mm-hmm.
Harris did his research when writing Red Dragon, and dove deep into the realm of serial killers and true crime by taking classes on the subject and interviewing FBI agents extensively. More specifically, the agents at the FBI Behavioral Science Unit in Quantico, Virginia.
Yep, and I believe that's where they shot or did some of the training, too. So
yeah, I mean all that outside course stuff mm-hmm. and like some of like the inside stuff, I believe. But that's also, obviously, where like Criminal Minds.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. So, the Criminal Minds, because Anthony knows nothing about the TV show.
I don't know. So I gotta keep this ignorance going.
So, Criminal Minds, the whole TV show, takes place in the Behavioral Science Unit in Quantico, Virginia. Everyone in the team is a behavioral analyst.
Oh, that's cool.
Or is a profiler for the BAU.
Really?
Yeah.
This and then Matthew Lillard being a bad guy are, like, the things that are pulling me towards this show.
So, watching Silence of the Lambs as, like, a teenager mm-hmm. and then immediately going into Criminal Minds, I wanted to be a profiler for years.
Really? What was the detriment there?
I didn't want to be an FBI agent, because you have to be an FBI agent.
Oh,
and, like,
I
there's,
see.
Like, you have to go through the whole process and, like, basically, like, it's the same reason why I didn't end up being a psychology major. My interest within the field is so niche
mm-hmm.
that having to...
To go through the steps to
go
get
through,
there.
Like, the big, like, macro steps to mm-hmm. get to, like, something so niche. I was just like, I'm not interested in this enough to follow through with it. But also I learned that, like, obviously, like, Criminal Minds is not an accurate representation.
Yeah.
This is not an accurate... Like, Silence of the Lambs is also not exactly an accurate representation.
Mm-hmm.
The going out and interviewing serial killers, like, that's an accurate representation. But you don't go out... Like, the people who work as a profiler,
yeah,
they don't go out and like arrest people.
Yeah, they're not part of that section. They're not. Of the team.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They don't like. It's pretty much a desk job.
Yeah,
like people. Like
no,
people,
there's one Indiana Jones fucking FBI guy out there that's just like, we're doing. I'm going to the field.
Yeah, like
Gary, stop.
Yeah, like they send you crime scene photos and then you write a report and you send it back.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
And yeah, so I mean, I like it in theory. It just, I don't think that's like. It, I don't know.
It that was the only part of the movie where I was just like, this is a little out there. Because yeah. She should just be chilling, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that there is some suspension of disbelief that I allow myself to have in this movie.
Best movie of all time, remember that?
It's my favorite movie of all time. I wouldn't say it's the best, but it's my favorite.
Ooh, next year we're doing the best one.
At some point during this, his father became terminally ill, and Harris was motivated to finish Red Dragon. He stayed in a rural shotgun-style house for 18 months in order to finish the book, and the setting helped him visualize his story, and the villain that would drive that story, Dr. Hannibal Lecter.
Yep.
So good. He dedicated the book to his father as well. When Red Dragon finally made it to store shelves, it was met with generally favorable reviews.
Yeah, generally.
But was seen as enough of a success to warrant a film adaptation. So it wasn't like the top of like a new, it wasn't like, yeah, a New York Times bestseller.
No, I think it did okay, and then, yeah, somebody picked up and was like, I'll get the rest of that. Yeah. We can make that. We can turn that into something.
Yeah. But that film was Manhunter, directed by Michael Mann, and released in 1986.
I don't know, he should put two N's.
Oh, for Manhunter?
For Manhunter.
That's ridiculous.
I don't know why.
Because then everyone would be hunting Michael Mann.
Yeah, the ego's too strong.
Oh, right?
The studio's like, you can't do it, Michael. Let me do it.
It gave audiences its first look at Hannibal Lecter. Brian Cox was cast in the role and based his performance on Scottish serial killer Peter Manuel, known as the Beast of Birkinshaw.
That's a pretty cool name.
I know. He is suspected of murdering up to 9 people over a 2-year time period and was the second to last person to be executed in Bar Linen Gallows.
Ooh.
I know I have some Scottish friends who will correct me on something that I'm sure I mispronounced. The film received wildly mixed reviews. Wildly mixed.
Yeah, it was really all over the place.
Upon release, and was absolutely a financial flop, but this didn't deter Thomas Harris, who was hard at work on Dr. Lecter's second appearance, The Silence of the Lambs.
I just, when you say wildly, I just think of, like, Dr. Salazar. Wildly mixed reviews.
I know, just someone, like, flailing their arms. In 1988, 2 years after Manhunter had flopped, Harris finally released The Silence of the Lambs, and it was, in this case, a huge success.
Yeah.
Children's novelist Ronald Dahl and author David Foster Wallace sang its praises, with the latter using it as curriculum during his time teaching at Pomona College.
Mm.
Ooh.
Fancy.
I know. With this level of success, a film adaptation was on its way, but Thomas Harris declined to be involved with the film in any way, collecting his check and going on with his private life, still decades away from doing another interview. However, he did wish the filmmakers good luck in, yeah, this process, in their endeavors.
Yeah, we'll get into his interview at the end, but he's very, like, yeah, fuck this. He's a novelist in his heart, man.
He seems like he has his stories to tell, and, like, yeah, that's all he's gonna tell.
He's like, you guys are asking me for the rights, so just, you know, fuck off. But the novel was set for a film adaptation even before it actually got released, with Orion Pictures and Gene Hackman partnering up to acquire the rights. I believe it was, in the documentary that I watched, they both split the money 50-50. So it was $250,000 from Orion and $250,000 from Gene Hackman to get the rights. So, what's-his-face walked away with $500,000. So pretty good.
All right.
Yeah. But they also had to get the rights to the name Hannibal Lecter. Annabelle Lecter. As it was...
Hannibal Lecter's lesser known douchier sister, yeah. Annabelle Lecter.
I like how you go with sister. Like, yeah, it's in the blood, but like only one of them's competent.
Well, actually, no. That's actually a horrible thing. I don't know if... Have you read any of the books?
No.
Have you watched any of the prequel movies?
No.
Okay, so Hannibal Lecter spoiler alert question mark, as a child was actually forced unknowingly to eat his own sister.
That's gross. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I think that contributes a little bit to his psyche. Yep. But yeah, the part of his backstory is that when he was a kid, basically his...
Annabelle?
Yeah, Annabelle. No, his sister was killed, and his house was, like, broken into, and the people who did it killed his sister, but he didn't know that she was dead, and they fed him her sister.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
That's pretty fucked.
I don't know all of the details, because DJ was explaining it to me, and I was really high when DJ was explaining it.
Oh, no.
But that's pretty much the gist of the story, is Hannibal Lecter was basically fed his sister without knowing it.
Fun times. Was that in the books?
It's in Hannibal, which is the prequel movie.
Yeah, okay. We're going to actually talk about that coming up.
And it's in the books.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's in the books as well. I just know for a fact it was in the movie.
That's pretty... Oh, yeah, there's a whole lot that goes into that prequel, actually.
Yeah.
But I was thinking Annabelle Lecter, like... Dr. Hannibal Lecter's a real doctor, and then Dr. Annabelle Lecter's, like, a wellness person.
Funny. It's, like, the fucking, like, goop or some shit.
And you gotta use these oils and these oils to roast your flesh. Yeah, that went too hard. All right. Let's get back to this one. Okay.
It's like a self-basting, like, turkey.
Oh, yeah, she could. She might be competent. Who the fuck knows?
No, but that's basically, like rubbing oil, like, getting a person who, like rubbing oils over themselves. That's like getting, like, a turkey that will, like, basically just, like
marinating.
Yeah!
She's like, it smells like canola oil. Like, yeah, no, it's fine. It's good for you.
Is there rosemary in this?
Oh.
It's good. It opens up the heart chakra.
The heart chakra. And the basil's just good for longevity.
Opens up the sinuses.
We gotta keep referencing Annabelle Lecter. That's great. But they actually had to get the name rights for Hannibal Lecter. And it was actually owned by the producer of Manhunter. But he did actually just lend the rights out to Orion for free. Because Manhunter flopped so bad. He did it as an apology.
Wow.
Yeah. Ted Talley was brought on board to write the screenplay as he was a friend of Harris. And he asked for a shot at it after receiving an advance copy of the book. Ted didn't have much in the way of writing credits before starting work on the adaptation. I think he was mostly a playwright. But he was actually in for a pretty rude awakening in his foray into Hollywood as the project lost funding. Apparently, Gene Hackman got cold feet, stemming from the pressure of directing such a big adaptation. Or... having to star another violent film, or his daughter talking him out of it after reading the novel. It really depends on your source. He was kind of mysterious.
Ooh.
Yeah.
He was vague about it, probably because he probably got talked out of it.
I think he got talked out of it by his daughter. Like, I think that was the conclusion, because there were some tabloidy ones that I saw about this, but then there was also, like, yeah, he just, you know, he didn't think he can do it, so it was a whole thing. Yeah, but Gene Hackman, despite Hackman's fuck-up, Talley was assured by the studio to just keep writing and let them deal with the financial stuff. So they actually did buy the rights back from Hackman for the $250. So they're like, yeah, peace out, buddy, wherever. We got a good writer here.
Yeah.
So he went on and pumped out a first draft of The Silence of the Lambs. Orion signed on Jonathan Demme to direct. Demme had a vast career spanning from films like Married to the Mob to Black Mama, White Mama, which he has a story credit for. And we just mentioned Black Mama, White Mama in our Blackula
episode. Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds like a blaxploitation.
Yeah, we have said it once in this podcast before. Mm-hmm. Apparently, Jonathan Demme has a story credit, so he helped develop the story credit for that. Yeah. Well, he used to work with Roger Corman, I believe. So he started off in exploitation.
Cool.
Yeah. But Demme signed on just before the first draft was complete, actually, based on the strength of the book. And that had he actually made very, very few changes to Talley's draft once he got it. So this thing was fucking fast.
Yeah, I'm going to have to, I mean, maybe in a post note, I'll consult with my sources, because one of my best friends, they read the book and the movie and has seen the movie, like, mm-hmm. so I want to get, like, input on, like, the similarities, because I haven't read the book.
Yeah, me neither, actually.
It's a pretty, I think it's a pretty big book.
It's a meaty book?
I think so.
It looks like an interesting read, though, to be honest.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
I want to read Silence of the Lambs, like, the book. I think that would be fun.
Yeah, no, that's good. We can bring notes later. but production was moving along very quickly, and the filmmakers had to make sure that their two leads were perfect for such an adaptation. And as always, to give us a lowdown on the casting process behind these lovely films you guys all love, Alex Webster, what do you got?
I always love how you give me casting.
Yeah. Okay. You're good at it. Casting and all on all the horse shit that happens to the actors. Like, just seeing you bookend it is awesome.
Okay, so we have to cast, of course, Starling and Lecter. Mm-hmm. Jodie Foster had been in touch with the studio as she was a big fan of the novel, so that's kind of how she got involved with the project. Mm-hmm. When she heard that Hackman fucked up the production, she expressed an interest in directing the film herself, but was turned down by the studio. I mean, I think she was still really young at this point.
Yeah, but she's always been fishing for that directorial
spot. Oh, yeah, I think she eventually got it.
Black Mirror. She did a really good episode of Black Mirror.
Yes, she She did Archangel. Jodie Foster directed Archangel.
Okay, she did a very okay episode of Black Mirror.
I liked it.
Yeah, no, that's why I say okay. It was good, yeah.
I believe it was Archangel.
It sounds familiar. It actually does.
No, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I remember the press for that. What? Because people were emphasizing that Jodie Foster directed.
No, I know that she directed an episode of that season. I just don't know if it's Archangel or something else.
We will consult Google at some point.
Well, do you remember which one Archangel is?
That's the second one, right? With the little girl?
With the, basically, yeah, with the little implant where you can see everything that's your happening. Kid sees. Yep. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that was Jodie Foster, yeah. Yeah. Same thing. We got it. We did it.
We figured it
we
out.
We know our entertainment.
I haven't seen any of the new season.
Any of that. I haven't seen shit.
I know. I heard it was actually was pretty bad.
I like Topher Grace, though, so I want to see the one he's in. Yeah. But that's it.
She still wanted to be part of the production, however, and lobbied to play the lead character, Clarice Starling. Foster wanted the part so badly after... Okay.
Oh,
so...
I said party in there. My bad. Foster wanted a party!
Okay. So Foster actually really wanted this part pretty badly after her own experiences with a stalker named John Hinckley. Hinckley would also go on to shoot Ronald Reagan in Her Name.
Yeah, I remember that.
I remember that too. And this was one of those things because I believe this was like prompted after she came out.
Really?
Yeah, because...
Oh, it was one of those proto-incel things, huh?
Yeah, because, like, yeah. I'm not... Don't entirely quote me on this, because she did a couple... She's done podcasts before kind of talking about it. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, after she came out, and mm-hmm. it was one of those things where it was just like, oh, you're gay? Like, I guess, like, I'm gonna go fucking kill Ronald Reagan?
You're not that perfect image of whatever I was fantasizing mm-hmm. about, and you're a real person with, like, this whole thing that I'm not about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I actually read that researching John Hinckley once.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's one of those
I knew she had a stalker who shot Ronald Reagan in Her Name, which was weird.
Yeah, and she actually had another one, too.
Yeah, she did. poor...
Next
poor,
sentence.
Poor Jodie Foster. She also had an experience with death threats thanks to another stalker, but the FBI helped her out greatly in both scenarios, and she had developed tremendous respect for the institution since. Demi had a few actors already in mind when going into the project, and was very set on his first choice for the role of Clarice Starling, Michelle Pfeiffer. Interesting choice.
Yeah.
Pfeiffer, however, found the subject matter to be far too violent and was uncomfortable with taking such a part, so she promptly turned his ass down.
Yep.
Just prior to this, Jodie Foster flew out to meet directly with Jonathan Demme, who to passionately lobby for the role. So what we've learned so far in this podcast is if you harass the director enough, you might get your
way. You might. Yeah, I like that he used the word might. I agree.
You might get your way. Please don't harass directors. And basically, she asked him to reconsider her as his second choice. She also told him personally... I just need to say, in all responsibility to women being victimized all around the world, you can't portray those FBI people as goofy Republicans. You've got to portray them in the correct way. All right.
But yeah, that's a direct quote from her, actually.
Way to go, Jodie Foster. Demi then asked Meg Ryan to play the part of Clarice Starling. She read the gruesome script and promptly turned his ass down. Yep.
Meg Ryan would not have been good as in this role.
Can you imagine Meg Ryan?
With her fucking haircut.
With her swoopy little 90s haircut and her sweet little voice. Like, what?
I mean, I feel like I can see a little bit Michelle Pfeiffer, though I think she would still try to dominate too much.
I think Michelle Pfeiffer would have been like, I can see what he was envisioning.
Yeah.
With Michelle Pfeiffer. Absolutely. But
it would have been different, but it still wouldn't have been bad.
Yeah.
But Meg Ryan, nah. You go do a Tom Hanks movie. Yeah. Fuck that shit.
Demi then approached the studio for the prospect of casting Laura Dern for the lead role. And as we can assume, based on the previous two ones, the studio promptly turned his ass down.
Yeah. Laura Dern was not famous enough for the studio. They're just like,
that. Absolutely not. Jodie Foster was then finally fucking cast as Clarice Starling. She was simply too passionate to turn away at this point. And at this point, basically, they were going to have to go through half of Hollywood to turn down. Like, it was half of Hollywood actresses at that point were going to have to turn down the role. Like, yeah, right? Fucking A.
She's like, okay, Janine Garofalo. Like, okay, you're just reaching now.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. As for who was going to play the part of the iconic Dr. Hannibal Lecter, Demi was set on his first choice for the role, Sean Connery.
Who?
Promptly turned his ass down.
Yeah. What do you do this time, Alex? How do you do it?
Connery called the film repugnant.
Yeah, that's the only quote I can get from anyone.
Okay, so my funny Sean Connery story. The fact that the trash can movie that I talk about all the time.
Which movie?
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. It made him retire from acting, and he did that.
He did that, right?
But he wouldn't do this.
He's like in the Burt Reynolds level of bad taste, but somehow has a career.
Honestly, the movie like gave him like such like a bad name, like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Which it's not a good movie, but it's my favorite kind of trash.
Alex has a soft spot in her heart for this one, and we all have those childhood movies where we're just I know it's garbage, but I'm gonna keep watching it.
Okay, I think total side point, but I brought this up at work one point to Anthony where I was like, yeah, I like the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Don't talk to me about it. I know what this looks like. And Anthony was just like, are you okay?
Yeah, you're like, but I want to talk about why you like this movie. You're like, no, I get shit for this. It's not, it's fine.
Like, I know.
It's a unique thing to like.
It's such a bad movie to like. It's a horrible movie for all intents and purposes. There is no reason that I should like that movie.
There's some crew that appreciates your sentiment so badly.
But I do.
Yeah. Poor Connery, though, like, literally quit acting because of that film. So
he retired.
That's hilarious.
Jesus. Anyway, Daniel Day-Lewis was also considered for the role, but he was juggling offers from two other projects, Pulp Fiction and The English Patient.
Yeah, big fucking projects, actually.
Yeah. Al Pacino, Dustin Hoffman, and Robert De Niro were also considered for the part, but at the end of the day, Demi wanted a Brit.
Yeah, he was like, don't give me all these mafia motherfuckers, all right?
Yeah, they're all very, like, I mean, except for Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah.
But Robert De Niro.
Al Pacino.
And Al Pacino.
Daniel Day-Lewis plays badass a lot of times.
Like, it's kind of like mafia kind of type.
Tough guys.
Even though in his head, I'm sure he was also imagining this skinny,
pale motherfucker.
Elegant motherfucker, apparently.
Okay, out of all these, who do you think? No, none of them. Daniel Day-Lewis.
I would say Daniel Day-Lewis.
Daniel Day-Lewis, that's it. Pacino, no, would have sucked.
No, yeah.
Hoffman would have been funny.
And can you imagine Dustin fucking Hoffman? Oh my god.
Well, De Niro was doing Cape Fear, I think, just before this, so he probably could have, he probably would have been the last time you would have seen De Niro with any effort. Like, was that right there?
That's true. Yeah, I think Daniel Day-Lewis probably, like, still, it still wouldn't have been great, but mm-hmm. I think he probably would have been my next choice.
Yeah. He would have been different.
Yeah.
He would have just been different.
It would have been different. But he offered the role to Anthony Hopkins based on his performance in David Lynch's The Elephant Man. So, back to our man David Lynch.
Yay. As always, we gotta find an excuse to bring him up.
As any opportunity to talk about him.
And his wicked do.
Yeah. We love it. Anyway, Hopkins had actually returned to London by that point in his career, having recently gave up on a career in Hollywood. Before being cast, he stated, "Well, that part of my life's over. It's a chapter closed. I suppose I'll just have to settle for being a respectable actor, pouncing around the West End and doing respectable BBC work for the rest of my life."
Oh, poor Hopkins.
Wow. And little does he know, like, this movie would launch him into, like, Hollywood stardom for the rest of forever.
Oh. For the rest of forever. Like, to the point where he gets knighted, like, 2-3 years after this.
Oh, yeah. But Hopkins would have one more shot at a Hollywood career, this time as Thomas Harris's cannibalistic serial killer, Dr. Hannibal Lecter.
Yep. And it's actually funny because I didn't put this detail in there, but what's his face? Anthony Hopkins was really, really confused because he never played a character like this. So he asked Jonathan Demme, he's like, "Why did you pick me, of all people?" He's like, "Well, your character in The Elephant Man, he's a kind, respectable person." He's like, but Dr. Lecter's not that. And he's like, "Yeah, but he's a kind, respectful man trapped in a psychotic mind. And I feel like you couldn't handle that." And Anthony Hopkins was like, "And then I learned exactly what the role was, and that was it." He was like, "Okay, cool. Good notes. Let's fucking do this."
God, so good.
Yeah, that's a good note from a director right there. I think that's a good way of categorizing the character, mm-hmm. too. So, you know, I mean, Demme had been at it for a while.
I'm just like, and then that just makes me think of, like, the scenes with Hannibal Lecter and, like, the eye contact and, and like, the cinematography and, so good.
The cinematography is fucking on point for this shit. And he's only in, like, 23 minutes of the movie.
I know. I was talking to my coworkers about that, too. And it was just like, "Did you know he won an Oscar for only 23 minutes? And I'm like, yeah.
Yep. I think he was the second shortest on the record for that one. I forget who'd had a shorter amount of time. I think it was for Doubt? I can't remember.
I don't follow Oscars and, like, who won what for what in what year. Like, unless I'm really, really familiar. And all I know is this one won a lot in 1992.
Yep, and we're going to talk about that in just minutes. To prepare for the role, Sir Anthony Hopkins studied several serial killers, while visiting prisons and attending court hearings. So he dove deep in this.
The commitment, though, because, like, court hearings are boring as fuck.
Yeah, and he's sitting there just like, "Oh, so you did what to the corpse? Okay."
Like, I did mock trial in high school, like... It's boring.
Yeah. And the whole creative team, they were looking at killers like Ed Gein and Ted Bundy and all of them as inspiration. The usuals, you know? But it's in the early 90s, so it's a little closer to it. So they're still kind of in the news cycle for them.
So they're kind of just like, ooh, exotic.
Yeah, exactly. Jonathan Demme and several cast members visited the FBI's Quantico, Virginia Training Center, the same place where Harris studied for Red Dragon, obviously. Scott Glenn, who played Jack Crawford, claims he lost a bit of innocence after that particular trip.
Of course he did.
Yeah. Jodie Foster found herself fascinated with an FBI agent she met at the facility, actually. 33-year-old Special Agent Mary Ann Krause, who became the inspiration for her take on Clarice Starling.
Love that for her.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, it was one of those situations where... like, she picked up a lot of her habits from just interviewing her constantly. She was
really?
Always, yeah. There was a scene where Clarice cries in her car, which is something she actually got from Agent Krause, who told her, like, "Sometimes it's too much, and I literally just walk out of the office, go in my car, and cry. And then I'm good, and I come back."
I can relate.
Yeah. You're like, "I do this for marketing."
I mean, I'm not interviewing serial killers, but sure. The fan's still on.
Ah, fucking A. Sorry, audience. We took a quick break, actually. And we forgot about our fan.
Anthony's room is a furnace, and we are approaching a Los Angeles summer.
Oh, dude. I am not prepared for this fucking summer. I'm totally not. But back to the filming here.
Yeah.
So it actually took place from November 15th, 1989 to March 1st, 1990. So pretty...
That's
kind of a long shoot,
that's
actually.
That's really... That's like... Oh my gosh. That's like almost That's like, what, almost 4 months?
4 months. Fucking A.
Jeez.
Yeah. Foster shot half the film before ever seeing Hopkins on set. And when they did film together, the two avoided each other and only interacted when needed on the set at the same time. Jodie Foster also purposefully avoided Ted Levine, who plays Buffalo Bill. This was more so for the sake of the performance rather than just kind of being awkward around him. Like, they kind of were with Hopkins.
Oh, were they just awkward around each other?
I don't think that one was performance-based. They were also, they were both kind of like, well, cool, man. All right, I'm going to go to my trailer now.
Oh, so they were just awkward? That's so funny.
I mean, Hopkins was, I'll get into it right now, but he was also being pretty Hannibal Lecter-y around set.
Was he just like kind of method acting?
Yeah, he's being a little bit of a weirdo. Okay. I think not like as much as the character. Like, he toned it down because that would be too much for people.
Yeah.
But he was still in that weird state where he's like, I'm going to just fuck with people, like, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And Jodie Foster was like, stay in character, stay serious. Fucking, you're in Hollywood now, man. Like, this was far different from Brooke Smith, who hung out with Levine constantly, despite spending the majority of her scenes together in a hole.
So, Brooke Smith, in this movie, she is obviously the girl who, the senator's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She plays a mom in Criminal Minds.
I knew Criminal Minds was coming. I knew it. She plays a mom, though?
Yes. She plays an all-grown-up character in Criminal Minds, and I love the episode. It's a really good episode.
I remember seeing her interview, and I was like, she does have that mom look a little bit now.
No,
now she's older?
Yeah, now that she's older and stuff. But yeah, when she shows up in Criminal Minds, every time I'm just like,
oh! Oh, she's recurring.
No, she's just she's a one-time character.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was just but I watch the show so often that like I watch the episode multiple times. So every time, every time I watch the episode, I'm just like, it just makes me happy. Like,
oh, it's this one.
yeah, and then that, and like every time the song that she's singing in the car, like anytime like that song comes on, like it makes me think of like her character and Silence of the Lambs.
And it takes place in the same FBI thing. Like, I think it's like, you're in a feedback loop to make this your best shit of all time.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. Yeah.
a lot of it all kind of works out, and I just think it's very funny that like her character, or that her, like, the actress got to be in an episode of Criminal Minds.
It comes back to the set, like, just, my old stomping grounds.
Yeah, it's just a cute little homage, in my opinion, even though, like, she doesn't play, like, an FBI agent or anything like that. But it's very cool. It's very cool.
She probably never even saw the set, to be honest with you, but whatever. But during the scene where Lecter and Sterling first meet, Hopkins improvised the dialogue where he mocks Clarice's southern accent. This hurt Foster, who thought it was a personal attack, making her on-screen reaction actually genuine. But she was later on say she's thankful that he actually took that step and was bold in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every day, Hopkins would sneak up on either Foster or Demi, and would show his fangs, the fangs of his teeth, and say, good morning, very creepily. Yeah. He would also occasionally, and without blinking, tell the crew, you know, Jonathan's the mad one. He never blinks. He's quite insane. Imagine Anthony Hopkins doing that shit.
Anthony Hopkins, like, in peak character of Silence of the Lambs, like, Hannibal Lecter.
He's like, to me, he's like giving them notes, like, hey, can you put the lighting over here? And he's like, oh, you're talking to the crew again.
Like, I would just, like, be like, stop being such a fucking weirdo.
You're like, okay, Anthony's doing his thing. Let's just let him go. Let him run out. He's going to get to the part right now. Oh, he's the real weirdo. Yeah, he is.
I just imagine, like, they would just, like, be, like, in the corner somewhere kind of, like, talking. And just be like, yeah, Anthony's being a real fucking, like.
Yeah, I don't know what's happening today.
Yeah, but then like, freaking, he would, like, come out, like basically just, like, pop out of a corner and just be like, I heard you were saying something.
He's being a real what?
Just be like, oh, Jesus.
He actually also did the tongue thing. Like, the little tongue flicker.
Yeah,
he would randomly do that on set towards people. Yeah, yeah. Like I said, he was a little, like, I think it was a little much for Jodie Foster.
I'm uncomfortable.
Yeah. The basement scenes were filmed in a disguised airplane turbine factory, and it was every bit as creepy and scary as it was in the actual film, according to the people who worked on the set.
Very little set design, I'm
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, they're like, we don't have to dress this up much, actually. Just put the safety nets around so they don't fall down a hole.
Yeah, and, you know, that would be bad.
Yeah, that would be bad for the union stuff, you know? but originally, Jonathan Demme had intended Levine's disturbing dance to be choreographed to the sound of Bob Seger's more up-tempo track, Her Struts. However, Levine suggested Goodbye Horses by Q Lazarus and improvised the infamous tucking.
Oh, so good!
Yeah. It's such a visually interesting scene because he's, like, so, like, just kind of, like, staring at the camera as it's happening.
Well, here's the thing, and, like, this, like, the Goodbye Horses scene, first of all, Goodbye Horses is a great song.
It's
also
a goddamn good song.
It's a great song, but also can't listen to it without thinking about this scene.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, for how much I love this movie, like, I can't.
But I think of this and the Jay and Silent Bob version where Jay does the dance.
Well, okay, here's the thing, though. It's like, and this is actually the second point that I was going to make. This scene, very similar to the I'm Sorry scene from the Blair Witch Project, both got launched into infamy for being, like, so raw, they're funny.
Yeah, exactly. It removed all the power of the scene.
Yeah, which sucks, because I think it's such a good scene, but, like, everyone, like, got so caught up on, like, him talking, or, like, the would you fuck me, I'd fuck me thing, that, like, it just, like, they just turned it into a joke, and that bugs the shit out of me. Like, okay, yes, it can be funny, I get it, like, but, like, it got stomped into the ground, like, literally beaten in, like, so many people did it, like, over and over and over, and it's just like, yes, we get it, it became
a cheap joke.
Yeah.
Cheap joke,
so
absolutely.
Very similar to the I'm Sorry scene in Blair Witch Project.
Oh my god, that thing got parodied fucking everywhere.
Same thing, and very similar to the Goodbye Horses scene.
The thing is, it totally fits still so well with the film. Like, it's like the perfect crescendo to the upcoming, like, to what happened and then to what's coming up next.
Well, that's the thing. And then also, so many people aren't paying attention. Like, they're so caught up on, like, all of the other weird shit going on that, like, I pointed out to someone the other day that he's wearing a scalp. And they were like, I thought it was a wig. And I'm like, it's a scalp.
We're like, well, we just paid attention to the tucking.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. Yeah. That's what they wanted. I love this movie.
It is a very good movie. But the night vision scene was actually filmed over, quote, a 22-hour punch-drunk marathon, according to Levine. So this was, like, raw-ass, just like, we gotta get this shit done. So everybody's exhausted. You can kind of see it in their faces, too. I think that helps with the anxiety on film. But the overall mood on the set has been described as genuinely upbeat. And the crew even made a board game out of the blueprints for the set itself. They called it the Gum Game. At the end of the shoot, Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins both revealed that they scared each other on set. Yeah.
I'm trying to imagine Anthony Hopkins being intimidated by, like, 5 foot nothing Jodie Foster.
Yeah, it's weird. Because she was eating a tuna sandwich. And, like, he literally stopped by on that last day on the set. And he was like, you know, you scared me. And she was, like, probably, like, fucking, like, dropped, like, the food from her mouth. Like, you scare me. It was like a kindred spirit moment.
Yeah.
And they hugged. They actually hugged right then and there.
That's so cute.
And then she went on to continue eating her tuna sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was in the Jodie Foster interview. But the film originally had a darker ending. After hanging up the call, the camera shot would have widened to reveal Lecter had captured Dr. Chilton, the man overseeing his stay at the Baltimore State Hospital for the criminally insane. So yeah, that would have been the actual ending, but I think they decided to just, like, tone it down and just be like,
oh, so they just allude to the fact that he got captured.
Yeah, exactly. I think it is more powerful. Yeah.
Oh, I agree. I think this is, again, like the showing not telling type of thing where mm-hmm. it's just like, you know what's going to go down.
Yeah.
And the, yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I think this was probably the better choice.
Yeah. Otherwise it's just like, look, see, he's scary. Boo. Credits.
And this one, it's just like, oh God, he's like terrifying.
Yeah. Like it's not even shit to him. He's just going to do it and then go off somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But 12 minutes of scenes detailing Clarice Starling and Jack Crawford being kicked off the case were cut. Based on a gut reaction from screenwriter William Goldman, who saw a rough cut of the film. This turned out to be a good idea. Jonathan Demme was actually very happy for that, because yeah. the film was already over 2 hours. But
it's the longest shit movie, and mm-hmm. I think one of my coworkers has never seen this movie, and like she's like, "Oh, we should watch it," and I'm and like she's just like, "I just have a really bad attention span," and like, "This is not a movie for you then."
Not
like,
your movie.
It's a long movie, and there's a like it's very hard to separate into like acts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not like a traditional it's kind not, of film.
No, you
yeah.
can't follow like first act, second act, third act, because like it just doesn't work that way. Like yeah. it ebbs and flows in a very interesting way that
it's
I
a very
enjoy.
Intertwined story.
Yeah,
very intertwined,
definitely. Like it like parts that are like, you know, like 45 minutes in, like you'll rely on later an hour in, or
yeah.
like or like an hour and a half in, like stuff like that.
That was their point actually with the night vision scene, because they introduced that stuff pretty early.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, we know by this point the audience is going to forget, which is why we're going to actually do the night vision angle, and that'll be our way to surprise them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forget who on the creative team determined that, but like that was a very good choice too. But yeah, the extra 12 minutes, first of all, was boring, and mm-hmm. it would have made the film 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
So they're like, nah.
It doesn't need to be that long.
Yeah, yeah. Nobody cares how if she got punished or not. Just, you know, she's back on the case. Bam.
Uh-huh.
But then, of course, the movie now is ready for release. So, Alex, what do people
release
think of this
and
fucking
reception.
Film?
Yep. Of course, there's no denying this. The film was huge. It was a huge hit with critics.
Mm-hmm.
It was huge with moviegoers. Many people, of course, who saw it highlighted Anthony Hopkins' take on Hannibal Lecter.
Yep.
This film also was really, really popular with women.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was listening actually to an interview that actually the last podcast guys did with Dan Aykroyd.
Oh, that was recent.
Yeah, it just came out like a couple days ago, which kind of dates when we're recording yeah. this, but whatever. But he was saying that Silence of the Lambs and Sleeping with the Enemy came out the same weekend.
Mm-hmm.
It also came out the same weekend as Nothing But Trouble. Which
oh,
is
of course it did. Oh, that makes that's why this is coming up. Okay.
Yeah, so that's why that's where this comes up, because he was basically saying that like Silence of the Lambs was super, super popular with women, and most women who went to go see it also brought, like, their significant others with them.
Really?
And it drew away from, like, from basically...
The masterpiece that was Nothing But Trouble?
Yes. Precisely.
You know who, actually, I didn't put this in here, but it was really not popular with was the LGBTQ community at the time.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and we could probably, I'm sure I can probably go into it later, but it's still a contentious subject to this day.
Really? To this day?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because the documentary I was watching,
yeah.
they spent, like, a solid 10 minutes, like, on that whole subject, and with, like, Ted Levine himself, like, throwing an argument out there, and it's like, you know, if people don't blah, blah, blah. Like,
yeah.
It was, like, a whole thing. It's,
yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of people, don't like the movie, and a lot of people, like I know a lot of trans people who love this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of those things where it's just like some people just chalk it up to times were different,
mm-hmm.
or some people just chalk it up to like a pathology like issue where it's just like you shouldn't be pathologizing trans people by saying like, you know, by I'm trying to think what would I phrase it that like kind of makes sense, but like basically this person, like how like the language that they use
yeah.
is kind of like an issue.
I see. Yeah,
in the film.
It's kind of like how in Psycho when they're like, it's a transvestite, right? Like kind
yeah.
of like that.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of. Yeah, exactly. And then in like in Silence of the Lambs, like he's just like he thinks he's like a transvestite, but
mm-hmm.
he's not. He's just like super fucked up, basically.
Yeah.
And like that's kind of like problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically. All of that stuff, and then like the question about whether or not Buffalo Bill actually is trans, and it's just like
yeah
it's a whole fucking thing. I actually hadn't even thought about that because I love this movie so much that it's one of those things that I don't engage with a whole
uh-huh.
lot, but it came up actually a lot in my a lot of my queer film classes.
Yeah, in college. It's a huge issue.
It's a huge thing, and there's a lot of discussion around it. I wish I had actually thought about this at length because I hadn't even.
Honestly, this just came to my attention today. So before even doing this, I was like, oh right, I saw that in the doc, because I remember the way they framed it in the documentary was a lot of the community at the time. Well, they showed because there was protests at the Oscars, every festival. There was protests.
There was at the time, because this came out early 90s.
91, yeah.
So, so at the time, this is really, which I think is really interesting because it's a give and a take, because you also, this is a movie where you have, at the time, I do believe I think Jodie Foster was openly lesbian at this point in time. I'm not entirely sure. But basically, you're having an openly gay actress play a starring role.
Yeah.
Which I think was super important.
Big deal.
It was a huge deal at the time.
Because that could be a career ender even in the early fucking 90s, to be honest.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And even with Jodie Foster, who, even though no matter how involved she was in Hollywood up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
But so I think it was really interesting because you have both sides of it, where it's just there is that misrepresentation where people, you know, people who might not think about it as critically might make that connection of
they're all like that.
They're all basically serial killers, which is a common misconception, and that's a common
people
thing.
Are dumb.
Exactly. People are dumb. As shit. Yeah, people are dumb, and people have that misconception based on this movie. So it would be amiss to say that this movie did not do harm, because it did.
I mean, that's the kind of thing that people who oppose bathroom bills are about the bathroom bills.
Exactly.
And shit like that.
Yeah, people who are about the bathroom bills and basically are just talking about men in dresses and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, of course they're going to expose themselves. Every man has a throbbing penis and is always attracted to the opposite sex and
it's horrible, horrible language and how people say certain things. And it's just a lot of that, you know, they build stereotypes based off of films like this because it was so critically acclaimed, and people basically were just okay, so this is how it is, since people are saying this is a great movie, this must be how it is in real life.
This must be correct.
And there's no room for criticism. And of course, I'm never going to say that a movie is 100% perfect in every single way.
Even your favorite movie of all time can critically fuck something up.
No, absolutely. Yes. I will absolutely admit, even if this is my favorite movie of all time, it would be irresponsible for me to say, as a queer person, that this movie did do harm. It would be irresponsible for me to say that it didn't.
Yeah. I think I remember at the time a lot of the framing that they were trying to do on the news thing or whatever it was that the trans representation in Hollywood has always been so vicious, even up until that point, and it was this is just another one.
Yeah.
Compared to, why can't you just, maybe give them a real personality?
Yeah, one of those things, even then, because, you're still talking about giving, basically, a serial killer, a backstory, and then, still giving that serial killer, whether or not they're trans or not, it's one of those things where it's, it's a slippery slope.
It is, right?
Because it's just you want villains of all shapes and sizes, but then also this is it's actually, it dives into this whole really interesting concept, and I know we're sidetracking.
No, it's fine. This is actually a big part of the movie.
But it's called queer coding, and it happens all the time, and it's very fun to talk about, but most Disney villains, for example, are queer coded.
In what way?
So, Ursula, for example, is, queer coded.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense,
So, that's, she's, the biggest example, where a lot of villains in movies are, it's not outwardly stated, or it's not, canon.
Yeah.
But a lot of villains in movies have contextual clues that imply that they might, that they're deviating from the norm.
Yeah.
Or there's something about them that is they're LGBT or queer.
Something
in some
that
way
might be scary to people that find that stuff terrifying.
So, and this can go in one of two ways. Either you grow up creating a connection between villain, like villainy, mm-hmm. and queerness, or you grow up basically having a raging hard on for villains.
Yeah. Only two options, guys. Totally, totally binary.
No. But I mean, and that's a joke. But yeah, like,
I know. I'm aware of that.
For the listeners, but no, I'm very serious about like the queer coding thing, because like it's something that like I didn't even realize until college, and they're like most like I mean not most, but like a lot of villains, especially in like children's cartoons.
Yeah, they give little subtle clues,
little
like that.
Subtle yeah. like things that make like certain characters like very flamboyant or very mm-hmm. like outwardly flashy, or like, you know, like Ursula is a great example, yeah. Jafar is a great example,
and a lot of times it's a character with an agenda that is the antithesis of your hero. Sometimes,
yeah,
yeah,
and so. So this happens a lot with, a lot of, like, the Disney villains. So a lot of, a lot of them are queer-coded. And mm-hmm. also there are a lot of ones that are queer-coded are also, like, are also people of color. Mm-hmm. It's very, very interesting how subtle these things can be. And when you're as kids, you're just absorbing this shit, obviously.
Well, another quick aside, actually. Dave Chappelle actually has a really good anecdote where he talks about the way that a lot of black actors who make it in Hollywood are kind of put in this position, because Martin Lawrence, Eddie Murphy, mm-hmm. Studio executives like to, when they get past a certain point, put a black actor in a dress and like feminize them up and make them look kind of drag and like mm-hmm. do that and like kind of like play with them.
I'm not super familiar with this.
Chappelle actually said, he's like, if for one of the movies he worked on, Robin Hood Men in Tights, I believe, like, it was like, oh, the joke is we'll put you in a dress, right? And it'll be funny. Like, just because you have a dress on and you're male. That's it. That's the joke. And Chappelle was like, I'm not doing it. And yeah. like the studio was trying hard to get
that. I
think
that's interesting.
Right? It's kind of weird how the industry like still looks for a way to like turn it into something like, look how
it's one of those things where it's like turning femininity into a joke and turning it into this issue where it's like turn traditional femininity or whatever into like this performance of a joke, and mm-hmm. where it's like, oh, see, that's funny, you should laugh because this like, you know, masculine man mm-hmm. is wearing a dress and that should be funny to you.
Yeah.
So now anytime you see a guy who might be interested in wearing something that might be traditionally feminine, mm-hmm. you should laugh at them.
Yeah. Yeah. You should never look at it positively. You should always either read the mockery or maybe a serial killer.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
That's a great way to Hollywood for you.
That's a great, great way to tie it all in. Yeah, it's either complete mockery or absolute villainy.
Mm-hmm. And Chappelle was like, I'm not doing any of that shit, which is very good. Honestly, a good moment.
No, I had no idea that there was like an actual like thing about like just trying to get like black men in Hollywood in dresses.
Yeah, the ones who make it big enough, you know?
That's like, really interesting.
It's one of the Chappelle's own theory. But yeah. Back to Silence of the Lambs, everybody.
thank you for bringing that up, because that was something that I totally, like, it's so funny, because it's come up so many times.
Really?
In like, college. I think I blocked a lot of it out, because I love this movie so much.
You're just like, don't ruin it for me.
No, I'm always open to, like, discussing it, because I know a lot of people who truly hate the movie because of mm-hmm. how harmful they find it.
Yeah.
Which is totally, you know,
They have every right to feel the way they do. Yeah.
I respect it, because also, like, I'm not, like, a trans woman.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to, like, I can't speak to that experience and, like, how that would be harmful to my experience.
You're like, no, you shouldn't be mad at all, you person who exists and are generally the one affected by it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you should feel something else.
Yeah, like, that's a shitty way to, you know, act about anything. So, yeah, anyway, but...
Let's get to these reviews, huh?
Yeah, for sure. Jeez. Dwayne Berg of The Hollywood Reporter said, Hopkins' performance is spectacularly unnerving and should win him future award nominations, which it did.
Yeah, he's totally on the point on that one.
However, one big detractor was Gene Siskel of Siskel and Ebert, who referred to it as a, quote, star-studded freak show, unquote, and said that Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, was better, which I question his taste.
Yeah, that's Siskel for you. He was a weird one, too.
He ended his review by referring to the film as a, quote, surprisingly trashy project.
Yeah, he did this on his TV show.
Wow. Mm-hmm. This turned into a heated debate with his co-host, Roger Ebert.
Our man.
Who gave it 3.5 stars, opening his review with, "It has been a good long while since I have felt the presence of evil so manifestly demonstrated as in the first appearance of Anthony Hopkins in The Silence of the Lambs."
Yeah, so he loved it. He actually made it one of his great movies, which is usually they're 4-star movies, but Ebert would later on do re-reviews of films. He was like, sometimes the stars may be different, sometimes 3.5 will be up there, but like, great movies. Mm-hmm. Where he would come back like, these are one of the ones that should never go away.
Yeah.
So yeah, even though he loved it, he still said it was very flawed in his review, but later on he'd be like, it's still one of the great ones, regardless of its flaws, you know?
Yeah. These stellar reviews, sans Gene Siskel, helped the film earn a respectable $13 million its opening weekend, where it defeated Sleeping with the Enemy, King Ralph, and Home Alone, the last of which was on its 14th weekend in theaters and still somehow in fourth place, and still beats Nothing But Trouble.
And still beat Nothing But Trouble. No, Home Alone. Yeah, Home Alone was a fucking juggernaut.
Like, yeah,
I looked at the highest grossing movies, and I looked. Home Alone obviously is a 1990 film because it was in 14 weeks.
Yeah,
it was number one for 1990. It beat everything.
Jeez.
Yeah.
It was at this point that The Silence of the Lambs did something that horror films seldom do. The same thing that had happened with The Blair Witch Project. It barely slowed down.
Mm-hmm.
More and more theaters were adding the film every week and was only dropping by small amounts from there on out. We live in an age where less than 50% after the first week is common. The Silence of the Lambs dropped about 16% and even less the week after.
Yeah, the week after was like 9, and it was like very small margins. I believe it stayed number one for like more than a month.
Wow.
Yeah.
Love that. By the end of its run, the film would be the fourth highest grossing film of 1991, right behind Beauty and the Beast, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and Terminator 2, Judgment Day.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting hodgepodge.
1991 was an interesting year for film, right?
You got Silence of the Lambs, Beauty and the Beast, and Terminator 2.
Ah, that's actually a pretty badass year. Okay, I can dig that.
I do like Beauty and the Beast. When it came time for the Oscars, The Silence of the Lambs did something very few films have done, let alone horror films. It swept the fucking floor.
Yeah, it swept like a motherfucker.
Oh,
guys.
My God.
We're going to get some context to this right now, because the way it swept is unheard of.
Oh, my gosh. I love this. So, the Big Five Academy Awards are recognized as Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Screenplay. Or Best Original Screenplay, or Best Adapted Screenplay, depending.
Yeah.
Only two films have ever won the Big Five, quote-unquote, prior to 1991. They are It Happened One Night in 1934.
Yep.
And One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in 1975.
That's a pretty big gap.
But also, like, great movie.
Yeah, that's a really good fucking movie.
The Silence of the Lambs was the third film to do it, and there has not been a fourth as of the recording of this podcast.
Yeah, there has not been a fourth.
Since the Oscars hasn't happened.
Yeah. Oh, this year it'll happen, yeah.
No, but as of right now, in June of 2019, the fourth one hasn't happened.
Nope. But only three in the history of Hollywood. Or the Oscars.
Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy.
So fucking cool. And just the fact that one of them is a horror film just makes my heart happy.
The best one's a horror film. Sorry.
I mean, haven't seen It Happen One Night, so I can't say for sure.
That's a pretty iconic one. But I think One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is actually a really good movie, too.
I really like it. But I watched it in my honors psych class in
high school. I watched it in psych class, too.
No way.
Yeah. The teacher was really happy to show us. And I was like, I've got to be here for longer. I'm like, oh, this is awesome.
I know. I was the same way. I was like, we're going to watch this whole movie. And I think it was during, like, star testing or something. And then we watched it. And I was just like, this is so fucking cool.
As soon as he leaves the asylum, I'm just like, keep going, man. Just keep going.
I know. Oh my gosh. Anyway, Jonathan Demme would continue to make acclaimed films and other projects until his death in 19...
We're doing this today. Twice.
until his death in 2017 at the age of 73.
In 1917, he went back in time and he and became Cecil B. DeMille.
And kicked the bucket.
Yeah.
In 2019, the creator of Hannibal Lecter, Thomas Harris, would at last give an interview to promote a book. It was with the New York Times, and he revealed himself to be a nature lover and a volunteer at the Pelican Harbor Seabird Station. He referred to fame as a nuisance.
Yeah, he doesn't care about
fame. He sounds like a crotchety old man.
Yeah, he's like...
That's what he sounds like my grandpa. That's what he sounds like.
He's 78 now.
So. Okay, well, my grandpa's 80.
Oh, see? One. Yeah, they're probably in the same same era.
I think he turned 80, 81 this year, yeah.
Damn.
He's like old.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's Silence of the Lambs there, but of course, we still have to learn what happened to Dr. Hannibal Lecter.
So, fun fact, in the movie, like, they keep calling him Dr. Hannibal Lecter, and I'm just like, shouldn't his freaking doctorate be, like, stripped at this point? Like, why does he still get the honorifics?
Why does he people have credentials?
Yeah, like, typically when you get a felony for eating people, you lose your doctorate. You don't get called doctor. Lose the honorifics.
What happened to Dr. Salazar, though?
He's
a Mexican doctor, though.
Well, also, it was a pseudonym, wasn't it?
Oh, was it? No.
Dr. Salazar. That wasn't his actual name.
No, you're right. He was Dr. something else, though. Oh, you're right. But then, yeah, I don't know if they kept calling him a doctor
so,
or not.
Typically, when one goes to prison, you lose all accolades and, like, achievements.
Yeah, okay, like, that makes sense, like, yeah.
Like, you know, if I were to get a doctorate degree and, like, it'd be like Dr. Alex Webster.
Yeah, and then you eat a bunch of people.
And then I, like, you know, like, it gets really hot in here one day and I, like, murder you.
That'll cool it down.
And then I go to prison, I would lose my doctorate. Like, I would no longer get, it's an honor, technically, and I would lose that honor.
Oh, well. Fiction for you,
yeah,
huh?
I know. It was just one thing that bugged me because DJ and I are both involved in, like, academics, so it's, like, one of those things where it's just, like, I know.
You're like, why wasn't we still... We can't acknowledge this. This is bullshit.
It's one of those little details that I'm such a stickler
that,
about.
That hangs you up for minutes in a podcast.
Every time.
But the character of Hannibal Lecter would be featured in a third novel, along with a film adaptation, simply titled Hannibal. They both received mixed reviews, but were very financially successful. And then after this, another adaptation of Red Dragon was on the way, this time from, I believe, Brett Ratner. It actually had better reviews, but worse box office. People were kind of getting burnt out on Hannibal Lecter.
I believe that.
Yeah. In 2006, Harris was pressured into writing Hannibal Rising because the owner of the rights, producer Dino De Laurentiis, said it was going to happen with or without his involvement. Piece of shit. All right. Hannibal Rising flopped hard, losing its opening weekend to Eddie Murphy's Norbit, followed by a second week drop of 59%. Pretty much the opposite of the Silence of the Lambs. So, big drop for Hannibal Lecter cinematically. Despite the decline, the character of Hannibal Lecter was given another chance by means of a network television show produced by Brian Fuller, simply titled Hannibal. How do you say it? Mads Mikkelsen. Starred as the title character. I can never say his fucking... I read it all the time, but, like, never say it out loud.
I'm pretty sure it's Mikkelsen.
Oh, okay. The show received rave reviews and returned prestige to Dr. Hannibal Lecter. It ran into a bit of trouble with audiences, though, as not many tuned in. Producer Dino De Laurentiis, who forced Harris to write Hannibal Rising, of course, blamed it on piracy.
So I don't think it was piracy. So basically, in my opinion, I was like peak internet nerd at the time that Hannibal had been on TV.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was one of those things where it was like people would watch it, or like people who weren't able to watch it because they had school or they had work or whatever, would just go back and watch it on streaming services later. Because this was also like, I was in high school. Streaming services existed and were like on the rise.
Yeah, they were actually pretty prominent.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
At that point, yeah, absolutely. From like 2009 to like 2013, which was the years I was in high school. I know.
But like 2011 is when I feel like the streaming was like, kick.
Yeah. I actually remember watching All of Heroes on Hulu while I was writing down geometry theorems.
Really?
In eighth grade.
Damn. So. Oh, that was back when Hulu was, like, free. Yeah.
Hulu
oh.
was totally free. Yeah. I remember that. I remember.
Oh, that was
fondly. That's when I first watched The Ring.
Really?
Yeah. I watched it by myself.
On free Hulu.
On free Hulu back in the day. But,
But I do remember the online world at this time, too, and Hannibal was, like, people loved it.
Yeah, I'm talking, like, specifically, like, fandom. Like, I'm talking, like, on Tumblr, like, mm-hmm. the fandom for Hannibal was nuts.
Yeah, really?
Nuts, like, with a capital N.
I'm thinking
with
Reddit fandom right here.
No, I'm thinking, like, capital N with, like, a Z at the end. Like, damn. Nuts.
What made them nuts?
In the typical way that most fandoms go, like freaking cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. No, they just were, like, ravenous. Like, they always, they wanted more content. Like, it's, you know, also always the involved in, like, the shipping stuff and, like, the, like...
Oh, that's, like, deep fandom right there. Damn.
I am basically a fandom, like, archaeologist.
See? And I'm thinking TV nerds on Reddit, which is just more like...
Very different...
Well, you know, fucking BBD.
No, very different audiences. Like, yeah. For me, it was very, like, culture-based. It was very, like, pathos-based. Mm-hmm. It was very, like, everyone's, like, has an emotion tied to it. And it was very, like, art, like, discussion-oriented.
See? And Hannibal is not a network TV show, man.
No, it was not. And a lot of people, like, would discuss the show, and there was a lot of, like, passion behind it. Mm-hmm. And then I believe when I think we're going to get into it, but, like, so basically what had happened was the show got canceled,
mm-hmm.
and the sheer amount of, like, fan outcry for more content.
Yeah.
Eventually, because it never stopped. Like, basically, like, some seasons or, like, some shows, once a show gets canceled, like, they, like, are really upset and, like, boohoo, boohoo, boohoo.
Dies off, yeah.
And then they get over it. Mm-hmm. Hannibal, it's been consistent.
Oh, yeah, because they're still being talked about to this day, even with
it's been kind of been, like, dangled in front of, like, Hannibal fans for mm-hmm. a really long time, where it's just like, maybe we will, maybe we won't. But I know Brian Fuller really wants it to happen.
Yeah.
And I know that, like, they've been at, like, Comic-Con, like, every fucking year. Like, they really want it to happen.
Yeah.
I know Mads wants it to happen. I know the other guy, his name is currently escaping me, also really it wants to be involved. But, yeah.
Yeah, so. No, actually, I didn't put all that, but I was reading up on that in here, and it was, what do you call it? The Fuller is still to this day attempting to get a fourth season produced. And the way he's trying to do it this time, which I put in here, is that he's trying to get the rights to Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, that would make sense.
Those rights are up for grabs. I don't know if they're up for grabs, but, like, they're out there. Mm-hmm. And he needs that to do the fourth season or get the fourth, at least part of the story for the fourth season for Hannibal. He wants to do a Silence of the Lambs treatment because he thinks, and this is what we're writing it on, quote, "I think the film adaptation is a perfect film. But there are a lot of interesting nooks and crannies in that book to explore in a television series."
I agree. Yeah. And I think one of the things to kind of launch us into, like, discussion here about the TV show, and I don't know if you... Have you watched any of the TV show?
No, I haven't seen it.
So it's very psychological. It's very kind of cerebral. And it's kind of, like, not imaginary, but, like, there's a lot of, like, not psychological, like, it's basically like you're on drugs.
Oh, okay. Like, surreal kind of elements
There's a lot of surreal shit to it.
Okay. For network TV, that I can see why it didn't get a lot of audiences. Yeah. Network TV people are stupid.
Yeah, there's a lot of surreal elements, and it requires, like, I think it's one of those things where it's like, it's not a background TV show.
No, definitely
it's
not.
It's not. It's just like Castle Rock.
Mm-hmm. That's mostly what network TV is background TV.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not. Mm-hmm. I believe if you're interested in watching Hannibal, like, it deserves your full undivided attention.
Yeah, I think that's why they're aiming at streaming services for the fourth season, if they're still trying.
Yeah.
Hannibal
also has Gillian Anderson in it, the love of my life. Yeah.
Well, now I gotta watch this.
I know. She's great at it.
Okay, but actually, I wanted to ask you a question specifically. Why is this your favorite film?
I mean, we kind of went over it. No, there is so much to go into about why I love this film. I think, so I guess kind of to answer your question, I'll go into my backstory. The first time I saw this movie, this was one of the few horror films I was allowed to watch as a teenager.
This one?
Yeah.
That's okay. I know. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Weird allowance. Yeah. Well, it's in all, for the most part, except for like one real fucked up scene. Mm-hmm. It's not a gruesome movie.
No.
It's psychological, but yeah. It's not gruesome. And like, that's what really always trips up my mom. My mom loves psychological stuff. Uh-huh. She loves serial killer stuff. Like, we're a very true crime oriented family.
Yeah, it's a pretty true crimey movie, though.
But my mom isn't a very, she doesn't like blood. She doesn't like gore. Like, so, like, that one scene where, like, his face is not his face and, like,
oh,
like,
my God, that's such a good scene.
It freaked me the fuck out. I'll tell you what. Like, it was not a good time
that
for me.
That special effect, though, was fucking awesome.
And I was so pissed because DJ called it when we watched it. Because DJ also had never seen the movie.
Oh, really?
I was shocked. Like, I was just like, oh, yeah, I need to watch Silence of the Lambs for the podcast. And DJ was like, you know I've never seen that movie, right? And, like, I was like, we've been together for over 4.5 years, and you've never seen this movie?
You're like, look at my goddamn wrist.
I know, and it's so funny, because DJ knows, and, like, knows it's my favorite movie, and knows all that stuff, but it's just like, I was just like, how have I never shown it to you if you've never seen it?
It's the one thing DJ was nervous about bringing up the whole time.
But, anyway, so I watched this movie as a teenager, and it was just so fun to me. Like, it was just like, I just loved, I loved Clarice, like, her character. I was always just like, fuck yeah, like, as a little teenager.
She's a very strong character.
She's a great, like, she's a really strong female character, and, like, you don't get a whole lot of that, especially in horror films.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, especially in, yes. Yes.
So, I think that I really liked her character. I liked the plot. It's an engaging storyline, and it keeps your attention for the whole 2 hours.
It does.
Which is really hard. Like, you know how hard it is for me, like,
to pay attention.
To pay attention to anything ever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I know this audience. Yes.
So I have a limited attention span at best, but this movie always, like, has captured my attention. It keeps my attention. It's visually appealing. The aesthetics really is, like, on point. Like, I love the storytelling. I love the cinematography, the music. Like, the score music is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the acting, of course. Like, I mean, I could go on and on, but I think for me, it just, yeah, I think it all of that just kind of came together and showed me what a good horror film could be before I knew what good horror could be.
Right? And then you got, like, prestige horror. Like, this is one of the few movies to get the big five.
Yeah.
And, like it's up there.
Definitely. And I think that's a great way to kind of, like, set the scene for me kind of going into horror
because you have
later
this standard
in life.
Yeah. Now your standard's over here. You're like, this is a fucking killer doll, man. No,
yeah. I mean, and even then, I still have critiques. You know, I'm always going to, I'm never going to, like, be blind to criticisms to a movie just because I love it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's
you
important.
Can love flawed things, people.
Yeah.
Like, that's just how life works.
Yeah. Well, you're allowed to have your problematic faves. I support you in your problematic faves.
Yes.
But yeah, so I there's just so many things to go off of. Like, Sir Anthony Hopkins just, like, killed it.
He did.
It's just, it's unsettling. Like, his performance is, like, one of the most unsettling things I've ever seen in my entire life.
It's one of those weird things, too, where he gets parodied a lot, but, like, he's still effective.
Yeah.
Like, no matter how many times people have tried to do the fucking Hannibal Lecter voice, me in this podcast. Like,
yeah.
It does not diminish Hannibal Lecter when you see him on screen.
Yeah, the amount of, like, hello, Clarice.
Hello, Clarice, yeah.
Yeah, like, it's so good.
In so many fucking movies, though, that line is said.
Yeah.
So many.
Oh, yeah, it's parodied left and right. And, like, but obviously, at this point, it's become a pop culture icon.
Yep.
Because of, I think, the popularity it received from critics. And, like, the praise it received from critics and how it just absolutely, like, how at the Grammys, like, it did get that, the big five.
Yeah, at the Academy Awards. The Grammys are for music, Alex.
Did I say Grammys?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
At Grammys when Sir Anthony Hopkins went
Oh my God.
And it did his freestyle rap.
I meant Oscars. You know I meant Oscars.
The beatbox of the lambs.
It's 10 o'clock at night. I'm going to dropkick you. It is 10 o'clock at night. I'm
you got
fucking...
best album, best I've... new artist.
Okay.
Lifetime Achievement Award.
I'm getting up and I'm walking out right now.
But we have more questions.
It's 10 o'clock at night and I've been up since 6 a.m.
Me too.
Oh my God.
This is our lives, guys. I know. Were just talking about this, actually.
Anyway.
We're wrecked.
Moving on. Moving on. Oh my God. I'm so embarrassed. Anyway. What do you think of the dynamic between Starling and Lecter? I do want to talk about this, but I do want to get your input.
I think it's, like, the perfect cat and mouse.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's whole... Because she's, like... She's clearly not quite to his level, but she's better than he expects.
Yeah.
And, like, with the whole... him going through her backstory, you learn later on, like, that's not her fucking backstory. But she plays it up and is able to be like, like, I'm kind of on your footing. And she shows a little bit of ignorance at first.
Yeah.
But, like, she's very quick to adapt. Because you see her right away, like, going to training and, like, kind of, like, get in the zone. Like, this is game time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, like...
She's a focused character.
She is.
Like, you can tell right off the bat, even from the beginning, like, she is a character who is determined and has, like, you know, she has goals. And, like, mm-hmm. she's willing to do what it takes. Like, even when she was meeting with her professor guy,
mm-hmm.
and he was just like, oh, I gave you an A. And she's like, you gave me an A-. Like, she is just like, no.
Like, bitch, this ain't a real A.
Yeah. And then... on the GPA scale, it's like 2.5 points less. Like, I don't think so. And then, or even like the scene, one of my favorite scenes, like that it sets up like how you perceive Starling mm-hmm. is when she's like going to the behavioral sciences unit and she gets in that elevator and she's surrounded by men.
Oh, yeah.
And she's 5 foot nothing.
And she's like, yeah.
And she's completely unfazed. Like, I mean, you can tell, like, I mean, for me watching that, like, I would imagine, and maybe this is just me projecting, like, she's probably internally somewhat fazed by it, but outwardly, like, she is, like, fucking, like, let's go. Mm-hmm. Like, she is not fazed by it at all.
She has that game 7 face.
Yeah.
Like, she definitely has that, like throughout when she knows she has to use it.
Yeah.
When she knows she has to use it. And actually, I remember in the making up, too, they had a very good point, because the creator was talking about how they, you know, they made her, characterized her in the story. And they're like, we wanted to make sure we had no element of romance or anything in there because she needed to stand on her own.
Yeah.
And even then, like, she had her being hit on. They had her being hit on, you know, by, like, who are the main
guys? The bad guys.
Yeah. And her response was, like, straight up just like, yeah, whatever you said, no, this is about the job. Like, like, so dismissive that it made the other person look stupid.
Yeah, well, that was part of it. Because, like, part of it when, like, she was, like, bringing, like, the bug to the bug guys. And, mm-hmm. and, like, she was just like, are you hitting on me?
Yeah.
And the guy's just like, yeah. And then she's just like, all right, whatever.
Yeah. Like, but they made a point because the director felt, Demi felt like, he's like, this just makes her stronger. Because she really is that focused on the job. Like, she doesn't need to worry about this petty bullshit when she has a killer to track down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The dynamic between Hannibal Lecter and Clarice Starling is, I think, the strongest aspect, one of the strongest aspects of the film, in my mm-hmm. opinion.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that first interaction between them, like, really set the stage for the rest of the movie because you just... Like, basically, I spend the rest of the movie just, like, crawling to more interactions between them. Because, mm-hmm. like, that's what I want to see.
Yeah.
I love seeing their interactions together. Just because, like, it's true. It's a cat and mouse type of feel where it's just, like, you can tell that they're both very calculating. And they're both mm-hmm. trying to figure the other person out. And it's just, it's very fun to watch.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, in between their scenes, you see her grow.
Yeah.
So you see her get better and learn more about what she's up against.
Yeah, and, every time.
Yeah, and then I even have pitfalls, and it has to come back to Lecter and still, like, where she thinks, like, okay, I can get him this way, and he still finds a way around it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are people who, like, truly, honestly believe that Clarice and Hannibal are, like, in love. Which is
fuck
weird.
No.
Which is, like, the weirdest thing to me.
No,
and I've seen
no.
it all over the place, and I'm just like, are we watching different movies?
They're fucking shippers.
Yeah. And I'm like, this is, like, the most, like, anti-romantic movie I've ever seen in my life. Like, which is refreshing, honestly.
Yeah. It's kind of sterile sometimes, but not in, like, a... It's a stylistic sterile film. It's so weird to turn it up that way, like to claim it like that. But well, yeah,
it's so great because like it shows like how like often she gets hit on, mm-hmm. especially by like the creepy psychologist guy.
Yeah, that's the one that, where she was like, "Yeah, fuck you." We're
where
not
she's
even doing
just
that.
Like
yeah.
where she's visibly uncomfortable and mm-hmm. she's just like, "Ugh, dude." And so I, but anyway, but yeah, for Starling and Lecter, I think just like their dynamic and is so amazing. And that's where like part of the cinematography also comes into play because eye contact is a huge part of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know like how much it had been utilized previously, but sort of those scenes in the beginning where when people are talking to Clarice and the camera is like just a hair off center mm-hmm. for eye contact, and then when you get to Hannibal, it's directly making eye contact with the camera.
In the behind the scenes, they said we use both the essential close-ups because when you do close-ups, you do head-on or you do that off thing so you mm-hmm. can have a dialogue shot. Say by using both of them in one scene, it really fucked with the audience, and that was their intention actually.
Yeah.
So that you found that's awesome because they literally were just like they made a point to do that very obviously for people.
Yeah, and I think because the use of eye contact I think was really important because it also like how it progresses throughout the scene mm-hmm. kind of shows Hannibal Lecter, in my opinion, eventually seeing Clarice on a level playing field.
Yeah, exactly. Throughout their conversations and everything.
Yeah. Because, and it's true, like, throughout the movie, Clarice, when people are like, oh, aren't you worried that he's going to, I don't know, come kill you? And she's just like, no, because he would consider that rude. And it's just like this weird, like, gentleman's agreement that they have. And it's just, like, and he's just, like, I won't, like, basically don't come after me, I won't come after you. And she's, mm-hmm. like, I can't promise that. And, like, it's just, it's a very interesting dynamic. I appreciate their dynamic. Obviously, I don't think it's romantic.
No.
But I appreciate their dynamic because there's obviously, like...
There's, like, a respect there.
Not even a respect, but, like, a... Because I think Starling is obviously repulsed by him.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, she's fascinated also. And I think that's an interesting dynamic that I wish was almost explored a little bit more, where she's, like, also juggling with this, like, fascination, but also repulsion of him.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking, like, respect, like, in being fearful of him, but respect for what he can do.
Yeah.
What he's capable of and, like, what anybody going against him would deal with.
I'm so upset, because I forgot DJ had never seen the movie. So, like, right before the phone call happens at the end of the movie, I was just like, I'm having an old friend for dinner. And like, and I said it because I just think it's such a funny line.
It's a very good line.
It's a great line.
One of my friends, Nick, says it a lot, actually.
And DJ was just like, what? Does that come up later? And I'm like, I forgot. I killed it.
No.
I ruined it for you.
That's the exclamation point right there.
I totally forgot you had never seen the movie. And I'm so sorry, DJ. I ruined it for you. I ruined the line.
Boo.
I know. I deserve it. I felt so bad. I was just like, oh, shit. Oh. And I was just like, don't worry about it. It comes up later. and when
it comes up in seconds.
Yeah, and when it did happen, I was just like, it just sounds better when he says it.
Wasn't that cool?
And DJ's just like,
I guess.
Yeah. It's such a good line.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, man.
Okay, but how about the other villain in this film? Buffalo Bill.
Yeah.
What do you think of this fucking guy?
I mean,
we went through the whole scene around it, but like as a character, how do you feel about him in the film?
It's fine. I think it was, I mean, I think Mr. Levine did a great job.
Yeah.
No, I'm kind of indifferent. Buffalo Bill's kind of like an ancillary character for me.
He is.
I think because so much of my attention of the film, like I mentioned before, is focused on Starling and Lecter.
Mm-hmm.
I think Buffalo Bill is kind of like, eh.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate, like, I think I feel so bad because I do really think that, what's his first name? Ted?
Ted, I think.
Ted Levine did a great job.
Adam Levine?
No. God, Lord.
Adam Levine is Buffalo Bill for, like, one music video.
That's very funny. No, Ted Levine, I think Ted Levine did a really great job, and I think he played the part how it needed to be played. Mm-hmm. I don't think Buffalo Bill was designed to be anything more than an ancillary character.
Yeah, I think he was designed to be a threat, and I think as a threat, he was threatening.
Yeah, no, I agree. Very threatening. I agree. That scene when... the girl was, like, getting out of her car and, like, he's, like, trying to get the couch into, like, the back.
Oh, that freaked. Was a good one.
That scared the shit out of me. Mm-hmm. Also, something that came up when I was watching it with DJ. The first time I watched this movie, and part of the reason it scared the shit out of me, at the time, I was a size 14. And in the back, mm-hmm. He's just like, are you about a size 14?
Oh,
scared
no.
the shit out of me. And I was, because, like, basically, and it was just, and, like, there's a scene where, like, he cuts off the back of her shirt and, like, looks at the size of it, mm-hmm. and it's a 14. And I'm and like, you're like,
I look at that when I shop.
I know. And, well, no, and I was just like, because it's one of those things where I'm just like, I'm going to get murdered. Because I also had far worse anxiety than I have now.
You're like, so lesson, never help anybody.
When I was, yeah. Well, I mean, I knew that before. But yeah, don't get into the lesson of if you're helping someone move furniture into a car, first of all, don't.
Yeah.
Second of all, if you're gonna be a nice person, don't get into the car. Have the other person get into the car. And
yeah.
Don't. Just don't. Like, don't get murdered.
They did it pretty brutally. Like that was fucking brutal.
Yeah, it was terrifying. But
for, like, a bloodless movie, the way they did violence is just visceral.
Yeah. Okay, so to close it out, what would you like to see in the future for the Hannibal franchise?
Old Man Hannibal, Logan, with Anthony Hopkins.
Old Man Logan.
Old Man Hannibal. He's just caning his way around.
He has to blend up his humans.
He has to...
Because he's got dentures.
He's got one of those little, like, day of the week vitamin things with different parts. He's like, I can only digest cartilage on this day.
That's disgusting.
Old Man Hannibal.
He can't eat people's livers with some fava beans no. and a nice Chianti.
With, like... a bunch of fucking kids trying to catch him because they, like, yeah. hear about him on forums and shit.
Yeah,
they're like some true really crime funny. Sleuths.
Oh, man.
Well, they obviously seek Jodie Foster. Mm-hmm. Clarice Starling, you're the one that blah, blah, blah. Get out of my fucking lawn. Slam door.
Yeah.
You don't know this man.
That's funny. That's super fucking funny. Oh, my gosh. I love that. Great concept. 10 out of 10.
Thank you. I came up with it right now because I actually hadn't thought about that question. I literally threw it at the end.
Good job.
What about you?
I actually would love to see the TV adaptation of Silence of the Lambs okay. for Hannibal.
For reals, I would love to see that.
Yes. No, I do want to actually watch Hannibal because I haven't seen it.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told I need to watch it multiple times by multiple people, and it's just one of those things that's, like, been on the list, and it's just one of those things I never got around to.
Always push it back, yeah. Yeah. I think that's why it got canceled. That's why. I know. That's literally why I think so, because
it's also one of those things where it's, like, if it's something's, like, super, like, psychedelic,
mm-hmm.
it's gonna, like, I need to be in a mood.
Yeah.
I need to be in the mood to get weird, you know?
Again, it should have been an HBO fucking show.
Yeah.
Like, the too good for network television.
Yeah, and I know, I don't know if it came up in Eli Roth's History of Horror, but I know Brian Fuller's, like, interviewed a lot in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure Hannibal comes up
at some point in there. Yeah, so, it has to.
Yeah, but, yeah, I'm excited to see, hopefully that's something that does happen, because I would love to see, like, a reimagining with, like, Clarice Starling and, like, you know, Mads Mikkelsen as, you know, as mm-hmm. Hannibal Lecter.
I know the first three seasons, I believe, were Manhunter. Like, not Manhunter, Red Dragon.
Yeah.
Done, like, in TV form.
Yes.
So I wonder how long the Silence of the Lambs adaptation would take. Like, if it be one season or two seasons? I don't know. I wonder if it was two, like, where would they cut it off?
Well, I think it would be interesting because I don't think he was arrested at the end of season 3.
No? Oh, no. So they can still play into that a little bit.
Exactly. So I'm saying they have some wiggle room because he's been in prison at the beginning of Silence of the Lambs for 8 years.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So in the beginning of Silence of the Lambs, it will have been like, he's like, I've been here for 8 years. So.
Oh, shit. By the time they finally get to make it, who the fuck knows? Maybe they just do a time skip.
Who knows?
Who knows?
But anyway, so if you stuck around this long, you're our freaking heroes. And as your reward... You made it. Yay.
Yay.
No, thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Oh, wait. We promised them something.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, so, as promised, we are done with June. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Alex Webster.
Happy birthday, me, first of all. Thank you. Thank you. But as we go into July, we have a very special announcement, and we will keep reminding you as this happens. But July will be our last month of season one.
We did it, guys.
So I'm very excited to announce it. But yeah, so at the end of July, we're going to take a month off to kind of, you know, get all of our shit together.
We need a month, guys. We work our asses off.
Yeah. we're going to take a month off, but we're not going to be not working.
No, definitely not. we just need to have time to write and not record.
Yeah, we need time to write and not record. We need time to work on some other projects for this project.
Yeah.
That we've been trying to get started for a really long time, but we just haven't had the time to really set aside when we're also recording. Mm-hmm. Please keep in mind that we both work full time and we live like 30 miles apart.
Yeah.
So this is the labor of love, but we came to this decision because we think that taking a little bit of a summer break would be helpful for us to make sure that we're constantly bringing you the greatest quality content that we possibly can bring you. So the month of August, we will be gone. We will, maybe every now and again, you know, we might do a mini-sode or something, drop something in your feed just so you don't forget we exist. But,
I mean, there's a lot more of you now than there was when we first started. Because I remember we were talking about this the first time we got like 1,000 views, listens, whatever it was. It took a little while.
Yeah.
And then the second one came and the third one came. We're like, oh, shit. That was much faster.
Yeah.
So thank you for listening. But also, just to tease you a little bit, another reason for the month off is we have a very, very big season opener and a very, very big October.
Yeah.
A very big Halloween for you motherfuckers.
Yeah.
So we got
to
prep.
We have to prep. We're changing. We're not changing the format or anything. We're not changing anything that you know and love.
Mm-hmm.
All of that's going to stay the same. We just wanted to kind of give everyone a little bit of a break. So, and us, most importantly.
Yeah. I need at least a couple days where I'm not writing all the time. Well, I am going to be writing all the time. Ah, fuck it.
Who knows? He's going to be writing, but I think with not a time pressure, I think will help.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, we want to do a bunch of stuff. Like, we want to definitely get a website started, and we want to do all of these things.
Some of the stuff you guys are asking for.
Yeah, which is so beyond cool. But no, so, I mean, this is just the first time we're bringing it up, but we will continue to remind you, I promise. This is not the last time you're going to hear us talk about it.
No.
But, yeah, so this was 1991. We didn't even say the year.
Oh, we didn't know.
But yeah, 1991. 1991's The Silence of the Lambs. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this week and for joining me for my birthday mandate. This has been so much fun and everything I had dreamed of and more. Thank you, everyone, for the birthday wishes and everything. It's been a really great month, so I appreciate that. Next month, as we kind of settle everything down before our break, our vacation, our late summer vacation, we have a fantastic month planned. We have a cool, cool theme.
We have a theme. Yeah, you guys are going to love it. Do we tell them now or just tell them next week?
I mean, I don't know. It's up to you.
Yeah, fuck it. What's on next week? Tune in next week for our theme.
Tune in next week for our really awesome theme that we definitely, like, we've been thinking about this and kind of, like, curating a great collection. Yeah. But it is, it is a theme with intent, yes, and we will get into it that next you'll week.
Love. We'll tell, yeah,
but if you like what you heard, the biggest compliment you can pay us is a 5-star review on iTunes. It means the world to us, and it helps keep us going.
Yeah, it does.
No, it truly means the world to us, and the amount of love we've received while we've been doing this podcast has been absolutely astounding. So thank you to every single one of you who has given us a 5-star review, has taken the time to leave a comment. Mm-hmm. It makes our day, and it keeps us going. So thank you
for me as well for all those things. Ditto.
Yes. He's very tired.
A little bit.
And again, if you want to stay up to date with everything going on with the podcast, please get in touch with us on social media. You can find us on Instagram at Horrible People's Podcast. That is HORROR BLE People's Podcast. And then you can find us on Twitter at Horror People Pod. You can find Anthony on Twitter and on Instagram at Hyrulean Hustler. And then you can find me, Alex Webster, on Twitter and on Instagram at Ghost Coffee Shop.
All right.
So I think that's just about it.
That's it, guys.
Thank you so much again, everyone. And we'll catch you next week.
Peace out, you motherfuckers.
Bye. Bye, guys.